I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. I really didn't know exactly how to attack it. It's a pretty broad area, but I noticed it was in mineralogy, so I thought I would take it from a very basic standpoint and talk about the wind erosion process and how this contributes to this issue. And here's how I'm going to attack it. First, I'm going to define the scope of the problem as I see it, and talk a little bit about soil formation. Curtis did a great job in getting me started on that, and the other speakers are all excellent. And this is such a broad topic. This is going to be kind of an overview and setting the stage for some of this as well. I'm going to talk about aeolian processes, and that's what we call wind erosion, aeolian, for wind-derived. And talk about the characteristics of sediment in general, and then look at local effects such as we get a lot of effects with vegetation interaction, coppice dunes and little islands of fertility. Then we'll talk about regional global effects, and we're going to talk a little bit about Las, Curtis, so stay tuned, and talk about some other kinds of soils. I think Julie did a great job with the issues involved with far-ranging dust. And terra rosa soils is another issue I'm just going to touch on. But aeolian deposits, they occur over much of the globe. Their origin and their development, it varies widely. Here, this black ones are the active dunes in the area. And the sand seas are these other bluer ones. And the lus are these brown and stipled areas, you can see there's a lot in Africa, and they're all over the world for various reasons, but all these are aeolian, so this will include maybe sand dunes, but also include dust, or lus, which occurs for various reasons, but I'm going to focus more or less today on the aeolian processes that are in dry land systems, and that would be arid and semi-arid. These are the areas around the world where you have these areas, and it's very significant areas around the world. But wind erosion is very active today. Here is a picture I took in 2011, coming back from New Mexico, and here came this big, we call these haboobs. You've probably all heard that term by now. It used to be, only the wind erosion people knew that term, but now everybody knows it because people seem to like that term. Although in some places you can't get it in government computers because it has a bad word in it. But I took a video of this, and so this is on our aeolian processes website. But it's active today. Here is Phoenix. We probably all heard about the things going on in Phoenix. Here's a big storm in 2011 in Phoenix. Here's Australia. It's all over. This was in 2013. I got off the internet. Here's a person in China. And so this is not a small problem. It's a huge problem and an opportunity. And so how do aeolian processes affect soils? And so let's kind of get basic and look at how they affect soils themselves. Hans Jenny back in 1941, perhaps many of you are aware of his classic work, or he talked about a soil is created from the process of climate and organisms acting upon apparent material as conditioned by topography through time. That's a real classic pedogenic book. Roy Simonson changed it up a bit in 59, and really this is what we've been discussing a lot today, that there are basically four things that happen in soils. There you have additions and losses and translocations or movement of material through the profile. Curtis covered a lot about that. And then there are transformations within the profile. And this is a pretty dominant feeling now. And through aeolian processes, you have additions and you have losses through blowing it off or bringing it in. And Julie had a good example of how hers were probably not losses through wind erosion, but wind erosion or aeolian processes were bringing her additions. And here's how it happens on the ground. You have material, we look at three basic size classes. We look at a material that's called creep, basically less than 1 millimeter, that kind of just rolls along with strong wind. Sometimes it's moved by these saltating or bouncing particles that strike it. Saltating particles close to the ground, they're about from 100 microns to 1 micron. And then the suspended dust. Suspended dust, it depends who you talk to. You know, suspended dust that goes globally is probably less than about 20 microns. Some might say 80 microns. The stuff that's near locally transported would be maybe 100 microns to 80 microns. So this suspension covers a wide range, but it's this material that's carried off the site, pretty much off site. But dominantly, it's going to be less than about 80 microns if it goes very far at all. And this is simply a wind profile pushing this material. And it happens where the soil is bare, it's loose enough, it's dry, and it's subjected to winds of a certain force. And it happens a lot in coarse textured soil. So where it's happening, you have to have these particles available. If it's all cloddy, it's not going to go. If it's covered with rocks or vegetation, it's not going to go. So you have to have these conditions at least during the wind erosion event. If it's too wet, it's not going to blow. So these conditions have to be bare, loose, dry, or at least some of it has to be loose so it's able to blow. Now, what we observe to measure the impacts, it depends on where we sample. I tend to sample the horizontally moving material above the surface. And if you're doing that, we have these catchers. You can actually put them in a field, and you maybe have several catchers to a height of 2 meters, and you can measure at various heights. But you can see when you do that, this graph shows you the fraction of the total catch at various size classes. And as you go up, the soils tend to get finer. And so if you're measuring at just one height, you're going to have one characteristic, maybe particle size, for that area. So what we typically do is we'll put a number of samplers in the field, and we'll measure them all, draw a graph that gives you the distribution of mass with height, and then you integrate under that to get the total mass. But of course, then you just, or if you want to measure things in that, you just add up all the samplers and get a homogeneous sample. So this is one of the basic things you have to be concerned with if you're sampling that actively horizontally moving material. Now, if you're sampling dust, you want to worry about where it's coming from, because it was interesting, Julie in her project measuring it, you know, in Puerto Rico, and you think, wow, how can that be dust? But it's coming down from the atmosphere, so you got to somehow measure it at some height. And if it's, and you could get a different result if you're out in the open versus you're under a tree. Scott Van Pelt and I did a study a way back where we found significant accumulations of material under vegetation because it was scavenging the dust. And at the very same field out in the open, we had different distributions. So that's something you have to concern yourself with sometimes. One of the things we look at is called, you can look at things like nutrients, organic matter. Here we're looking at plant available nutrients, cation exchange capacity, and organic matter content. What we typically do when we're doing this is, well, what's moving in the atmosphere? You measure the material in the dust, and you measure it in comparison to the source material. And so you just get it's called an enrichment ratio. And here we have we're measuring from 15 centimeters to 2 meters, and we looked at the enrichment ratio. You can see the organic matter was twice as high in just this moving dust, which is pretty close to the surface. And so these are very close to the source enrichment ratios. Here's the actual amount versus the enrichment ratio. And so you can see that, now this is close, now if you're measuring dust that's quite high up, the enrichment ratio can be quite a bit more, 7, 10. I mean, you have to compare it to your source location. And so this was a study we did in Big Spring years ago. Now, if you're considering how much is lost out of a site, it can be quite large, and particularly in desert areas or in Big Spring, Texas. That is a semi-arid region, about 450 millimeters of precipitation. We had a study, quite a long study, from 89 to 97, and we observed soil loss in about a 3-hectare field from 40 to 290 megagrams per hectare per year. That's a lot when you consider 11 is T-value. That's a lot of loss. And actually, if you wanted to, I think you can still see it. If you go to Google and you look at Big Spring, Texas, just north of town, you can still see the circle. We did this in a circle, and we pretty much made a bowl out of that in those years of that erosion, because it eroded and eroded and inches of material, and you could, from the satellites, you can see a circle. But we kept that thing smooth and erodible. We tilled it, flattened it, and rolled it, so it was very erodible, because we were trying to see what we could get. Now, if you're thinking about materials that are moved, creep and saltation materials moved very close to the surface, it is trapped near the source, and it affects the local vegetation, local features. And this slide kind of illustrates a number of things, and it's from a publication in 2010 by Ravi and many others. And it looks at, here we're at the horizontal axis, we're looking at the connectivity. And by connectivity, I'm talking about how does the surface, how is it connected between plants? And it has a lot to do with water erosion and wind erosion. Here, connectivity is going from low to high. And if you look at, this is soil erosion going from low to high. If we look at this landscape, we have a full grass. Here we're getting some shrub encroachment. Here there's a lot of shrubs. And here is the last, what you get around Las Cruces in the Desert Project. A lot of connectivity. And here you have this at the Desert Project as well. You have a lot of open areas that is an area that will blow, and you have these islands that connects, that collects the material. And you have this patchy vegetation, and this vegetation, they act as islands of fertility. It's catching the material that's blowing off of the adjacent material, and it has specific characteristics, and I'm going to talk about that. For example, we have a study back in 2009 where they compared the inner shrub and the shrub patches. Now, in the shrub, they had higher porosity, a higher infiltration capacity, higher water holding capacity, higher hydraulic connectivity of the pores, better structural stability, more organic matter, and lower bulk density. And this is just material coming in, being caught by the vegetation, and causing these properties. And so if you're moving strontium or whatever, you have to think about how these things move on the landscape, and if you move, where are you measuring it relative to vegetation? In another study that looked at the total and mineralizable nitrogen and the total and respirable carbon and just in the upper 5 centimeters, and they found that was quite higher under the plants than in the opening. So this is this island of fertility effect that we gather under these areas. Now let's shift gears a little bit, and let's talk about this material that goes distances. Where does it go? Well, that depends. Okay, there are some of the dust affects ecosystems nearby. Here's a study that was done by Hermes and Graham, 2011, and that was in the Soil Science Society of America Journal. And they looked at the Frye Mountains near California, and they saw how this mountain acted as a baffle and collected the dust coming off of the Mojave. And they looked at, they put sediment traps all over the area, and they measured quite a range of dust in this study. And so they found that this material that was blowing seasonally or once in a while off the Mojave, and they looked at the properties of the dust. It was a very interesting study, and I refer you to that if you haven't seen that. Now, studies have discovered that, if you look at the distance, it can do different things. The distance from the dust source. And there have been a lot of classic studies on lust, but you can even do this in areas in Texas where we had a dust source, the Pecos River Valley, and Dr. B.L. Allen and one of his students measured the soil properties going away from that source, and they could very clearly see decreasing sand size with the distance and its clay content. If you look at the soil map of Texas, you can see it's sandy towards Mexico to the southeast, and it fines as you go north and east. It was for the prevailing winds back then out of the Pecos River system. And there are a lot of studies in the literature. I don't want to talk about them all, but there are many. If you look at particularly the lust literature, for example, there are classic studies about the lust coming off of the Mississippi River and how it's very thick close to the river and thins out as you go out, these sorts of things. Curtis, what about this lust? You can see a lot of the lust occurs at mid-latitudes. That's generally associated with glaciation, where the glaciers would bring the dust, this so-called glacial dust, deposit it in big outwash areas, and the big winds would blow it around. And those are the higher latitudes. But we have lust, this is the stipal areas, we have lust located around deserts. And back in 87, Soren Pai had a discussion about this, and it's still active in the literature, what they were talking about. So how does this lust form in deserts? Well, when you have lust, you have to have some sort of medium silt-sized transport material, because it's going to be felt relatively close to the source. It's medium silt, and that's a classic lust material. So you have to have that. And so you have to have that silt source in wind. You got to put those together. And then you have to have some sort of trap to stop it. If you have this lust, sometimes it's just basically the distance from the source, and it's going to drop out. And so you got to kind of factor that in as well. But they were saying that, you have to have some sort of trap, although that's not strictly the case. So they're looking as much as Hermes and Graham did. They talked about topographic obstacles, maybe moist ground or some sort of vegetation, something to capture that lust. And during the glacial periods, this happened around certain areas that were neighboring to semi-arid regions. So it's still attached to glaciers, but now it's in semi-arid and arid regions. And they find that in Sinai, Soviet Asia, and China. But then there are other places they don't find it, and that's the mystery. You have, why not? So what are we missing in the Chihuahuan Desert there in the Las Cruces area? That's not either. Is it a lacking of a lust source of what is the source? What happened during the Pleistocene that there was no lust source there? Because it's very common in some deserts. Now let's back off a little bit and talk about deposition rates. We have a lot of various deposition rates around the world. Dust has been measured, it seems like, everywhere. And the amount you find will vary depending upon the location. And this dust that comes, it affects ecosystem. You can see from this map, you can see where the dust coming off of Asia is affecting the Caribbeans. Dust off of Africa actually affects the Caribbean islands and South America, as Julie pointed out. And there have been studies where they've looked at the Florida Keys and Caribbean, and they've looked at such things as various ratios to track the dust. So the Sahara is an important dust source. There are other sources. Chadwick looked at dust sources in the Hawaiian coming out of Asia. We have sources from Australia affecting the ocean, and particularly having some issues with the Great Barrier Reef and the corals. But here's something that Julie brought up, and it has to do with, you can use this dust and look at what it does to the the soil, here's a picture of the soil loss rate, idealized soil loss rate from the soils in Hawaii. And here is the amount of, this is a soil loss rate of phosphorus. But here is the accumulation of phosphorus. And so he maintains that that phosphorus is the source of phosphorus, and it sustains the productivity of these rainforests. And without it, we wouldn't have these rainforests. And then finally, you've maybe heard of the terra rosa soils, the very red soils. Well, they form on such things as basalt. And so where are we going to get things weathering out of basalt to find that soil? Where Muse demonstrated that a lot of that terra rosa soil formation comes from the dust from Africa. And again, he goes into great detail to kind of demonstrate that. So dust really is affects the genesis, the mineralogy, the fertility, the landscape evolution of many things in these arid and semi-arid regions, and in the humid regions as it goes across the ocean. We have a website. We have an International Society for Aeolian Research. If you're interested, here's a website. We have a Facebook. We have a journal. If you're doing aeolian research and you wish to publish, our journal is called Aeolian Research. It has an impact factor of 3.04, not too shabby. And so we invite you to publish there. Thank you.